unalterable ash cat. You will have to give a little more attention to your manners, or I will throw you out of the window." The mannequin smiled a smile of malicious content and security, puffed a whiff of smoke contemptuously toward me, and said with a still more elaborate drawl,
"Come, go gently now. Don't put on too many airs with your betters."
This cool snub rasped me all over, but it seemed to subjugate me too for a moment. The pygmy contemplated me a while with his weasel eyes, and then said in a peculiarly sneering way,
"You turned a tramp away from your door this morning."
I said crustily, "Perhaps I did, perhaps I didn't. How do you know?"
"Well, I know. It isn't any matter how I know."
"Very well. Suppose I did turn a tramp away from the door. What of it?"
"Oh, nothing. Nothing in particular. Only you lied to him."
"I didn't. That is, I..."
"Yes, but you did. You lied to him."
I felt a guilty pang. In truth, I had felt it 40 times before that tramp had traveled a block from my door. But still, I resolved to make a show of feeling slandered. So I said,
"This is a baseless impertinence. I said to the tramp..." "There, wait. You are about to lie again. I know what you said to him. You said the cook was gone downtown and there was nothing left from breakfast. 2 lies. You knew the cook was behind the door, and plenty of provisions behind her."
This astonishing accuracy silenced me, and it filled me with wondering speculations, too, as to how this cub could have got his information. Of course, he could have culled the conversation from the tramp, but by what sort of magic had he contrived to find out about the concealed cook? Now the dwarf spoke again.
"It was rather pitiful, rather small in you to refuse to read that poor young woman's manuscript the other day, and give her an opinion as to its literary value. And she had come so far, too, and so hopefully. Now, wasn't it?"
I felt like a cur. And I had felt so every time the thing had recurred to my mind, I may as well confess. I flushed hotly and said, "Look here. Have you nothing better to do than prowl around prying into other people's business? Did that girl tell you that?"
"Never mind whether she did or not. The main thing is, you did that contemptible thing, and you felt ashamed of it afterwards." "Aha! You feel ashamed of it now!"
This with a sort of devilish glee. With fiery earnestness, I responded, "I told that girl in the kindest, gentlest way that I could not consent to deliver judgment upon anyone's manuscript, because an individual's verdict was worthless. It might underrate a work of high merit and lose it to the world, or it might overrate a trashy production and so open the way for its infliction upon the world. I said that the great public was the only tribunal competent to sit in judgment upon a literary effort, and therefore it must be best to lay it before that tribunal in the outset, since in the end it must stand or fall by that mighty court's decision anyway."
"Yes, you said all that. So you did, you juggling, small-souled shuffler. And yet, when the happy hopefulness faded out of that poor girl's face, when you saw her furtively slip beneath her shawl the scroll she had so patiently and honestly scribbled at, so ashamed of her darling now, so proud of it before, when you saw the gladness go out of her eyes and the tears come there, when she crept away so humbly, who had come so..."
"Oh, peace! 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 Blister your merciless tongue! Haven't all these thoughts tortured me enough without your coming here to fetch them back again?" Remorse, remorse. It seemed to me that it would eat the very heart out of me. And yet that small fiend only sat there leering at me with joy and contempt, and placidly chuckling. Presently he began to speak again. Every sentence was an accusation, and every accusation a truth. Every clause was freighted with sarcasm and derision. Every slow-dropping word burned like vitriol. The dwarf reminded me of times when I had flown at my children in anger, and punished them for faults which a little inquiry would have taught me that others and not they had committed. He reminded me of how I had disloyally allowed old friends to be traduced in my hearing, and been too craven to utter a word in their defense. He reminded me of many dishonest things which I had done, of many which I had procured to be done by children and other irresponsible persons, of some which I had planned, thought upon, and longed to do, and been kept from the performance by fear of consequences only. With exquisite cruelty he recalled to my mind, item by item, wrongs and unkindnesses I had inflicted, and humiliations I had put upon friends, since dead.
Who died thinking of those injuries, maybe, and grieving over them, he added, by way of poison to the stab. For instance, said he, take the case of your younger brother, when you two were boys together many a long year ago. He always lovingly trusted in you, with a fidelity that your manifold treacheries were not able to shake. He followed you about like a dog, content to suffer wrong and abuse, if he might only be with you. Patient under these injuries, so long as it was your hand that inflicted them. The latest picture you have of him in health and strength must be such a comfort to you. You pledged your honor that if he would let you blindfold him, no harm should come to him. And then, giggling and choking over the rare fun of the joke, you led him to a brook thinly glazed with ice and pushed him in. And how you did laugh! Man, you will never forget the gentle, reproachful look he gave you as he struggled, shivering out, if you live a thousand years. Oh, you see it now! You see it now! Beast! I've seen it a million times, and shall see it a million more. And may you rot away piecemeal, and suffer till doomsday what I suffer now for bringing it back to me again. The dwarf chuckled contentedly, and went on with his accusing history of my career. I dropped into a moody, vengeful state, and suffered in silence under the merciless lash. At last this remark of his gave me a sudden rouse. 2 months ago, on a Tuesday, you woke up away in the night, and fell to thinking with shame about a peculiarly mean and pitiful act of yours— toward a poor ignorant Indian in the wilds of the Rocky Mountains, in the winter of 1800 and— Stop a moment, devil! Stop! Do you mean to tell me that even my very thoughts are not hidden from you? It seems to look like that. Didn't you think the thoughts I have just mentioned?
If I didn't, I wish I may never breathe again. Look here, friend. Look me in the eye. Who are you?
Well, who do you think?
I think you are Satan himself. I think you are the devil.
No.
No? Then who can you be?
Would you really like to know?
Indeed I would.
Well, I am your conscience.
In an instant I was in a blaze of joy and exultation. I sprang at the creature, roaring, "Curse you! I have wished 100 million times that you were tangible, and that I could get my hands on your throat once! Oh, but I will wreak a deadly vengeance on—" Folly! Lightning does not move more quickly than my conscience did. He darted aloft so suddenly that in the moment my fingers clutched the empty air, he was already perched on the top of the high bookcase, with his thumb at his nose in token of derision. I flung the poker at him and missed. I fired the bootjack.
In a blind rage, I flew from place to place and snatched and hurled any missile that came handy. The storm of books, inkstands, and chunks of coal gloomed the air and beat about the mannequin's perch relentlessly, but all to no purpose. The nimble figure dodged every shot, and not only that, but burst into a cackle of sarcastic and triumphant laughter as I sat down exhausted. While I puffed and gasped with fatigue and excitement, my conscience talked to this effect. "My good slave, you are curiously witless. No, I mean characteristically so. In truth, you are always consistent, always yourself, always an ass. Otherwise, it must have occurred to you that if you attempted this murder with a sad heart and a heavy conscience, I would droop under the burdening influence instantly. Fool, I should have weighed a ton and could not have budged from the floor. But instead, you are so cheerfully anxious to kill me that your conscience is as light as a feather. Hence, I am away up here out of your reach. I can almost respect a mere ordinary sort of fool, but you... Pah! I would have given anything then to be heavy-hearted, so that I could get this person down from there and take his life. But I could no more be heavy-hearted over such a desire than I could have sorrowed over its accomplishment. So I could only look longingly up at my master and rave at the ill luck that denied me a heavy conscience, the one only time that I had ever wanted such a thing in my life. By and by I got to musing over the hour's strange adventure, and, of course, my human curiosity began to work. I set myself to framing in my mind some questions for this fiend to answer. And just then one of my boys entered, leaving the door open behind him, and exclaimed, "My! What has been going on here? The bookcase is all one riddle of—" I sprang up in consternation and shouted, "Out of this! Hurry! Jump! Fly! Shut the door! Quick, or my conscience will get away!" The door slammed to, and I locked it. I glanced up and was grateful to the bottom of my heart to see that my owner was still my prisoner. I said, "Hang you, I might have lost you. Children are the heedlessest creatures. But look here, friend, the boy did not seem to notice you at all. How is that?"
"For a very good reason. I'm invisible to all but you."
I made mental note of that piece of information with a good deal of satisfaction. I could kill this miscreant now if I got a chance, and no one would know it. But this very reflection made me so light-hearted that my conscience could hardly keep his seat, but was like to float aloft toward the ceiling like a toy balloon. I said presently, "Come, my conscience, let us be friendly. Let us fly a flag of truce for a while. I'm suffering to ask you some questions."
"Very well. Begin."
"Well, then, in the first place, why were you never visible to me before?"
"Because you never asked to see me before. That is, you never asked in the right spirit and the proper form before. You were just in the right spirit this time, and when you called for your most pitiless enemy, I was that person, by a very large majority, though you did not suspect it."
"Well, did that remark of mine turn you into flesh and blood?"
"No, it only made me visible to you. I am unsubstantial, just as other spirits are."
This remark prodded me with a sharp misgiving. If he was unsubstantial, how was I going to kill him? But I dissembled and said persuasively, "Conscience, it isn't sociable of you to keep at such a distance. Come down and take another smoke." This was answered with a look that was full of derision, and with this observation added,
"Come where you can get at me and kill me? The invitation is declined with thanks."
"All right," said I to myself. "So it seems a spirit can be killed after all. There will be one spirit lacking in this world presently, or I lose my guess. Then I said aloud, "Friend!"
"There, wait a bit. I am not your friend. I am your enemy. I am not your equal. I am your master. Call me my lord, if you please. You are too familiar."
"I don't like such titles. I am willing to call you sir. That is as far as..."
"We will have no argument about this. Just obey. That is all. Go on with your chatter."
"Very well, my lord, since nothing but my lord will suit you. I was going to ask you how long you will be visible to me."
"Always."
I broke out with strong indignation.
"This is simply an outrage, that is what I think of it. You have dogged and dogged and dogged me all the days of my life, invisible. That was misery enough. Now to have such a looking thing as you tagging after me like another shadow all the rest of my days is an intolerable prospect. You have my opinion, my lord. Make the most of it." "My lad, there was never so pleased a conscience in this world as I was when you made me visible. It gives me an inconceivable advantage. Now I can look you straight in the eye and call you names and leer at you, jeer at you, sneer at you. And you know what eloquence there is in visible gesture and expression, more especially when the effect is heightened by audible speech. I shall always address you henceforth in your own sniveling drawl, baby."
I let fly with the coal hod. No result. My lord said,
"Come, come, remember the flag of truce."
"Ah, I forgot that. I will try to be civil, and you try it too for a novelty. The idea of a civil conscience. It is a good joke, an excellent joke. All the consciences I have ever heard of were nagging, badgering, fault-finding, execrable savages. Yes, and always in a sweat about some poor little insignificant trifle or other. Destruction catch the lot of them, I say. I would trade mine for the smallpox and 7 kinds of consumption and be glad of the chance. Now tell me, why is it that a conscience can't haul a man over the coals once for an offense and then let him alone? Why is it that it wants to keep on pegging at him day and night and night and day, week in and week out, forever and ever, about the same old thing? There's no sense in that and no reason in it. I think a conscience that will act like that is meaner than the very dirt itself."
"Well, we like it. That suffices."
"Do you do it with the honest intent to improve a man?" That question produced a sarcastic smile, and this reply,
"No, sir. Excuse me. We do it simply because it is business. It is our trade. The purpose of it is to improve the man, but we are merely disinterested agents. We are appointed by authority and haven't anything to say in the matter. We obey orders and leave the consequences where they belong. But I am willing to admit this much. We do crowd the orders a trifle when we get a chance, which is most of the time. We enjoy it. We are instructed to remind a man a few times of an error, and I don't mind acknowledging that we try to give pretty good measure. And when we get hold of a man of a peculiarly sensitive nature, oh, but we do haze him. I have known consciences to come all the way from China and Russia to see a person of that kind put through his paces on a special occasion. Why, I knew a man of that sort who had accidentally crippled a mulatto baby. The news went abroad, and I wish you may never commit another sin if the consciences didn't flock from all over the earth to enjoy the fun and help his master exercise him. That man walked the floor in torture for 48 hours without eating or sleeping, and then blew his brains out. The child was perfectly well again in 3 weeks.
"Well, you are a precious crew, not to put it too strong. I think I begin to see now why you have always been a trifle inconsistent with me. In your anxiety to get all the juice you can out of a sin, you make a man repent of it in 3 or 4 different ways. For instance, you found fault with me for lying to that tramp, and I suffered over that. But it was only yesterday that I told a tramp the square truth, to wit, that it being regarded as bad citizenship to encourage vagrancy, I would give him nothing. And what did you do then? Why, you made me say to myself, ah, it would have been so much kinder and more blameless to ease him off with a little white lie, and send him away feeling that if he could not have bread, the gentle treatment was at least something to be grateful for. Well, I suffered all day about that. 3 days before, I had fed a tramp and fed him freely, supposing it a virtuous act. Straight off, you said, oh, false citizen, to have fed a tramp. And I suffered as usual. I gave a tramp work. You objected to it. After the contract was made, of course. You never speak up beforehand. Next, I refused a tramp work. You objected to that. Next, I proposed to kill a tramp. You kept me awake all night, oozing remorse at every pore. Sure I was going to be right this time, I sent the next tramp away with my benediction. And I wish you may live as long as I do if you didn't make me smart all night again because I didn't kill him. Is there any way of satisfying that malignant invention which is called a conscience?
Ha ha! This is luxury. Go on.
But come now, answer me that question. Is there any way?
Well, none that I propose to tell you, my son. Ass! I don't care what act you may turn your hand to. I can straightway whisper a word in your ear and make you think you have committed a dreadful meanness. It is my business, and my joy, to make you repent of everything you do. If I have fooled away any opportunities, it was not intentional. I beg to assure you it was not intentional.
Don't worry, you haven't missed a trick that I know of. I never did a thing in all my life, virtuous or otherwise, that I didn't repent of within 24 hours. In church last Sunday, I listened to a charity sermon. My first impulse was to give $350. I repented of that and reduced it 100. Repented of that and reduced it 100. Repented of that and reduced it 100. Repented of that and reduced the remaining 50 to 25. Repented of that and came down to 15. Repented of that and dropped to $2.50. When the plate came around at last, I repented once more and contributed 10 cents. Well, when I got home, I did wish to goodness I had that 10 cents back again. You never did let me get through a charity sermon without having something to sweat about.
Oh, and I never shall. I never shall. You can always depend on me.
I think so. Many and many's the restless night I've wanted to take you by the neck. If I could only get hold of you now.
Yes, no doubt. But I am not an ass. I am only the saddle of an ass. But go on, go on. You entertain me more than I like to confess.
Well, I am glad of that. You will not mind my lying a little, to keep in practice. Look here. Not to be too personal, I think you are about the shabbiest and most contemptible little shriveled-up reptile that can be imagined. I'm grateful enough that you are invisible to other people, for I should die with shame to be seen with such a mildewed monkey of a conscience as you are. Now, if you were 5 or 6 feet high and—
Oh, come! Who is to blame?
I don't know.
Why, you are. Nobody else.
Confound you, I wasn't consulted about your personal appearance.
I don't care. You had a good deal to do with it, nevertheless. When you were 8 or 9 years old, I was 7 feet high and as pretty as a picture.
I wish you had died young. So,
you have grown the wrong way, have you?
Some of us grow one way and some the other. You had a large conscience once. If you've a small conscience now, I reckon there are reasons for it. However, both of us are to blame, you and I. You see, you used to be conscientious about a great many things. Morbidly so, I may say. It was a great many years ago. You probably do not remember it now. Well, I took a great interest in my work, and I so enjoyed the anguish which certain pet sins of yours afflicted you with, that I kept pelting at you until I rather overdid the matter. You began to rebel. Of course, I began to lose ground then, and shrivel a little, diminish in stature, get moldy and grow deformed. The more I weakened, the more stubbornly you fastened on to those particular sins, till at last the places on my person that represent those vices became as callous as shark skin. Take smoking, for instance. I played that card a little too long, and I lost. When people plead with you at this late day to quit that vice, that old callous place seems to enlarge and cover me all over like a shirt of mail. It exerts a mysterious smothering effect, and presently I, your faithful hater, your devoted conscience, go sound asleep. Sound? It is no name for it. I couldn't hear it thunder at such a time. You have some few other vices, perhaps 80 or maybe 90, that affect me in much the same way.
This is flattering. You must be asleep a good part of your time.
Yes, of late years. I should be asleep all the time, but for the help I get.
Who helps you?
Other consciences. Whenever a person whose conscience I am acquainted with tries to plead with you about the vices you are callous to, I get my friend to give his client a pang concerning some villainy of his own, and that shuts off his meddling and starts him off to hunt personal consolation. My field of usefulness is about trimmed down to tramps, budding authoresses, and that line of goods now. But don't you worry. I'll harry you on them while they last. Just you put your trust in me.
I think I can. But if you had only been good enough to mention these facts some 30 years ago, I should have turned my particular attention to sin. And I think that by this time I should not only have had you pretty permanently asleep on the entire list of human vices, but reduced to the size of a homeopathic pill at that. That is about the style of conscience I am pining for. If I only had you shrunk down to a homeopathic pill and could get my hands on you, would I put you in a glass case for a keepsake? No, sir. I would give you to a yellow dog. That is where you ought to be, you and all your tribe. You are not fit to be in society, in my opinion. Now, another question. Do you know a good many consciences in this section?
Plenty of them.
I would give anything to see some of them. Could you bring them here, and would they be visible to me?
Certainly not.
I suppose I ought to have known that without asking. But no matter, you can describe them. Tell me about my neighbor Thompson's conscience, please.
Very well. I know him intimately. Have known him many years. I knew him when he was 11 feet high and of a faultless figure. But he is very rusty and tough and misshapen now, and hardly ever interests himself about anything. As to his present size, well, he sleeps in a cigar box.
Likely enough. There are few smaller, meaner men in this region than Hugh Thompson. Do you know Robinson's conscience?
Yes. He is a shade under 4.5 feet high. Used to be a blonde. Is a brunette now. But still shapely and comely.
Well, Robinson is a good fellow. Do you know Tom Smith's conscience?
I have known him from childhood. He was 13 inches high and rather sluggish when he was 2 years old, as nearly all of us are at that age. He is 37 feet high now, and the stateliest figure in America. His legs are still racked with growing pains, but he has a good time nevertheless. Never sleeps. He is the most active and energetic member of the New England Conscience Club. Is president of it. Night and day you can find him pegging away at Smith, panting with his labor, sleeves rolled up, countenance all alive with enjoyment. He has got his victim splendidly dragooned now. He can make poor Smith imagine that the most innocent little thing he does is an odious sin. And then he sets to work and almost tortures the soul out of him about it. Smith is the noblest man in all this section, and the purest, and yet is always breaking his heart because he cannot be good. Only a conscience could find pleasure in heaping agony upon a spirit like that. Do you know my Aunt Mary's conscience?
I have seen her at a distance, but am not acquainted with her. She lives in the open air altogether, because no door is large enough to admit her.
I can believe that. Well, let me see. Do you know the conscience of that publisher who once stole some sketches of mine for a series of his, and then left me to pay the law expenses I had to incur in order to choke him off?
Yes, he has a wide fame. He was exhibited a month ago, with some other antiquities, for the benefit of a recent member of the Cabinet's conscience that was starving in exile. Tickets and fares were high, but I traveled for nothing by pretending to be the conscience of an editor, and got in for half price by representing myself to be the conscience of a clergyman. However, the publisher's conscience, which was to have been the main feature of the entertainment, was a failure, as an exhibition. He was there, but what of that? The management had provided a microscope with a magnifying power of only 30,000 diameters, and so nobody got to see him after all. There was great and general dissatisfaction, of course, but...
Just here there was an eager footstep on the stair. I opened the door, and my Aunt Mary burst into the room. It was a joyful meeting, and a cheery bombardment of questions and answers concerning family matters ensued. By and by, my aunt said,
"But I am going to abuse you a little now. You promised me, the day I saw you last, that you would look after the needs of the poor family around the corner as faithfully as I had done it myself. Well, I found out by accident that you failed of your promise. Was that right?"
In simple truth, I never had thought of that family a second time. And now such a splintering pang of guilt shot through me. I glanced up at my conscience. Plainly, my heavy heart was affecting him. His body was drooping forward. He seemed about to fall from the bookcase. My aunt continued,
"And think how you have neglected my poor protégé at the almshouse, you dear, hard-hearted promise-breaker!"
I blushed scarlet, and my tongue was tied. As the sense of my guilty negligence waxed sharper and stronger, my conscience began to sway heavily back and forth. And when my aunt, after a little pause, said in a grieved tone,
"Since you never once went to see her, maybe it will not distress you now to know that that poor child died months ago, utterly friendless and forsaken."
My conscience could no longer bear up under the weight of my sufferings, but tumbled headlong from his high perch and struck the floor with a dull, leaden thump. He lay there writhing with pain and quaking with apprehension, but straining every muscle in frantic efforts to get up. In a fever of expectancy, I sprang to the door, locked it, placed my back against it, and bent a watchful gaze upon my struggling master. Already my fingers were itching to begin their murderous work.
"Oh, what can be the matter?" exclaimed my aunt, shrinking from me, and following with her frightened eyes the direction of mine. My breath was coming in short, quick gasps now, and my excitement was almost uncontrollable. My aunt cried out,
"Oh, do not look so! You appall me! Oh, what can the matter be? What is it you see? Why do you stare so? Why do you work your fingers like that?"
"Peace, woman," I said in a hoarse whisper. "Look elsewhere. Pay no attention to me. It is nothing, nothing. I am often this way. It will pass in a moment. It comes from smoking too much." My injured lord was up, wild-eyed with terror, and trying to hobble toward the door. I could hardly breathe, I was so wrought up. My aunt wrung her hands and said,
"Oh, I knew how it would be. I knew it would come to this at last. Oh, I implore you to crush out that fatal habit while it may yet be time. You must not, you shall not be deaf to my supplications longer."
My struggling conscience showed sudden signs of weariness.
"Oh, promise me you will throw off this hateful slavery of tobacco."
My conscience began to reel drowsily and grope with his hands, enchanting spectacle.
"I beg you, I beseech you, I implore you. Your reason is deserting you. There is madness in your eye. It flames with frenzy. Oh, hear me and be saved. See, I plead with you on my very knees."
As she sank before me, my conscience reeled again, and then drooped languidly to the floor, blinking toward me a last supplication for mercy with heavy eyes.
"Oh, promise, or you are lost. Promise and be redeemed. Promise, promise and live."
With a long-drawn sigh, my conquered conscience closed his eyes and fell fast asleep. With an exultant shout, I sprang past my aunt, and in an instant I had my lifelong foe by the throat. After so many years of waiting and longing, he was mine at last. I tore him to shreds and fragments. I rent the fragments to bits. I cast the bleeding rubbish into the fire, and drew into my nostrils the grateful incense of my burnt offering. At last, and forever, my conscience was dead. I was a free man. I turned upon my poor aunt, who was almost petrified with terror, and shouted, "Out of this with your paupers, your charities, your reforms, your pestilent morals! You behold before you a man whose life conflict is done, whose soul is at peace, a man whose heart is dead to sorrow, dead to suffering, dead to remorse, a man without a conscience. In my joy I spare you, though I could throttle you and never feel a pang. Fly!" She fled. Since that day my life is all bliss, bliss, unalloyed bliss. Nothing in all the world could persuade me to have a conscience again. I settled all my old outstanding scores and began the world anew. I killed 38 persons during the first 2 weeks, all of them on account of ancient grudges. I burned a dwelling that interrupted my view. I swindled a widow and some orphans out of their last cow, which is a very good one, though not thoroughbred, I believe. I've also committed scores of crimes of various kinds, and have enjoyed my work exceedingly, whereas it would formerly have broken my heart and turned my hair gray, I have no doubt. In conclusion, I wish to state by way of advertisement that medical colleges desiring assorted tramps for scientific purposes, either by the gross, by cord measurement, or per ton, will do well to examine the lot in my cellar before purchasing elsewhere, as these were all selected and prepared by myself and can be had at a low rate, because I wish to clear out my stock and get ready for the spring trade. 1876
Punch Brothers Punch. Will the reader please to cast his eye over the following verses and see if he can discover anything harmful in them? Conductor, when you receive a fare, punch in the presence of the passenger, a blue trip slip for an 8-cent fare, a buff trip slip for a 6-cent fare, a pink trip slip for a 3-cent fare. Punch in the presence of the passenger. Chorus. Punch, brothers, punch with care. Punch in the presence of the passenger. I came across these jingling rhymes in a newspaper a little while ago, and read them a couple of times. They took instant and entire possession of me. All through breakfast they went waltzing through my brain, and when at last I rolled up my napkin, I could not tell whether I had eaten anything or not. I had carefully laid out my day's work the day before, a thrilling tragedy in the novel which I am writing. I went to my den to begin my deed of blood. I took up my pen, but all I could get it to say was, "Punch in the presence of the passenger." I fought hard for an hour, but it was useless. My head kept humming a blue trip slip for an 8-cent fare, a buff trip slip for a 6-cent fare, and so on, without peace or respite. The day's work was ruined. I could see that plainly enough. I gave up and drifted downtown, and presently discovered that my feet were keeping time to that relentless jingle. When I could stand it no longer, I altered my step, but it did no good. Those rhymes accommodated themselves to the new step, and went on harassing me just as before. I returned home and suffered all the afternoon, suffered all through an unconscious and unrefreshing dinner, suffered and cried and jingled all through the evening, went to bed and rolled, tossed, and jingled right along the same as ever. Got up at midnight, frantic, and tried to read, but there was nothing visible upon the whirling page except punch, punch in the presence of the passenger. By sunrise I was out of my mind, and everybody marveled and was distressed at the idiotic burden of my ravings. Punch! Oh, punch! Punch in the presence of the passenger! 2 days later, on Saturday morning, I arose at tottering wreck, and went forth to fulfill an engagement with a valued friend, the Reverend Mr. Blank, to walk to the Talcott Tower, 10 miles distant. He stared at me, but asked no questions. We started. Mr. Blank talked, as is his wont. I said nothing. I heard nothing. At the end of a mile, Mr. Blank said, "Mark, are you sick? I never saw a man look so haggard and worn and absent-minded. Say something. Do." Drearily, without enthusiasm, I said, "Punch, brothers, punch with care. Punch in the presence of the passenger." My friend eyed me blankly, looked perplexed, then said, "I do not think I get your drift, Mark. There does not seem to be any relevancy in what you have said. Certainly nothing sad. And yet, maybe it was the way you said the words. I never heard anything that sounded so pathetic. What is—" But I heard no more. I was already far away with my pitiless, heart-breaking blue trip slip for an 8-cent fare, buff trip slip for a 6-cent fare, pink trip slip for a 3-cent fare, punch in the presence of the passenger. I do not know what occurred during the other 9 miles. However, all of a sudden Mr. Blank laid his hand on my shoulder and shouted, "Oh, wake up, wake up, wake up! Don't sleep all day. Here we are at the Tower, man. I have talked myself deaf and dumb and blind and never got a response. Just look at this magnificent autumn landscape. Look at it, look at it. Feast your eyes on it. You have traveled. You have seen boasted landscapes elsewhere. Come now, deliver an honest opinion. What do you say to this?" I sighed wearily and murmured, "A buff trip slip for a 6-cent fare, a pink trip slip for a 3-cent fare, punch in the presence of the passenger." Reverend Mr. Blank stood there, very grave, full of concern apparently, and looked long at me. Then he said, "Mark, there is something about this that I cannot understand. Those are about the same words you said before. There does not seem to be anything in them, and yet they nearly break my heart when you say them. Punch in the... how is it they go?" I began at the beginning and repeated all the lines. My friend's face lighted with interest. He said, "Why, what a captivating jingle it is! It is almost music. It flows along so nicely. I have nearly caught the rhymes myself. Say them over just once more, and then I'll have them sure." I said them over. Then Mr. Blank said them. He made one little mistake, which I corrected. The next time and the next he got them right. Now a great burden seemed to tumble from my shoulders. That torturing jingle departed out of my brain, and a grateful sense of rest and peace descended upon me. I was light-hearted enough to sing, and I did sing for half an hour straight along as we went jogging homeward. Then my freed tongue found blessed speech again, and the pent talk of many a weary hour began to gush and flow. It flowed on and on, joyously, jubilantly, until the fountain was empty and dry. As I wrung my friend's hand at parting, I said, "Haven't we had a royal good time? But now I remember you haven't said a word for 2 hours. Come, come, out with something." The Reverend Mr. Blank turned a lackluster eye upon me, drew a deep sigh, and said, without animation, without apparent consciousness, "Punch, brothers, punch with care. Punch in the presence of the passenger." A pang shot through me as I said to myself, "Poor fellow, poor fellow, he has got it now." I did not see Mr. Blank for 2 or 3 days after that. Then, on Tuesday evening, he staggered into my presence and sank dejectedly into a seat. He was pale, worn. He was a wreck. He lifted his faded eyes to my face and said, "Ah, Mark, it was a ruinous investment that I made in those heartless rhymes. They have ridden me like a nightmare day and night, hour after hour, to this very moment. Since I saw you, I have suffered the torments of the lost. Saturday evening I had a sudden call by telegraph and took the night train for Boston. The occasion was the death of a valued old friend, who had requested that I should preach his funeral sermon. I took my seat in the cars and set myself to framing the discourse, but I never got beyond the opening paragraph, for then the train started, and the car wheels began their clack, 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 and right away those odious rhymes fitted themselves to that accompaniment. For an hour I sat there, and set a syllable of those rhymes to every separate and distinct clack the car wheels made. Why, I was as fagged out then as if I had been chopping wood all day. My skull was splitting with headache. It seemed to me that I must go mad if I sat there any longer, so I undressed and went to bed. I stretched myself out in my berth, and, well, you know what the result was. The thing went right along just the same. Clack, 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 a blue trip slip. Clack, 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 for an 8-cent fare. Clack, 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 a buff trip slip. Clack, 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 for a 6-cent fare. And so on, and so on, and so on. Punch in the presence of the passenger. Sleep? Not a single wink. I was almost a lunatic when I got to Boston. Don't ask me about the funeral. I did the best I could, but every solemn individual sentence was meshed and tangled and woven in and out with, "Punch, brothers, punch with care, punch in the presence of the passenger!"
and the most distressing thing was that my delivery dropped into the undulating rhythm of those pulsing rhymes, and I could actually catch absent-minded people nodding time to the swing of it with their stupid heads. And, Mark, you may believe it or not, but before I got through, the entire assemblage were placidly bobbing their heads in solemn unison, mourners, undertaker, and all. The moment I had finished, I fled to the anteroom in a state bordering on frenzy. Of course, it would be my luck to find a sorrowing and aged maiden aunt of the deceased there, who had arrived from Springfield too late to get into the church. She began to sob and said, "Oh, oh, he is gone, he is gone, and I didn't see him before he died." "Yes," I said, "he is gone, he is gone, he is gone. Oh, will this suffering never cease?"
"You loved him, then? Oh, you too loved him."
"Loved him? Loved who?"
"Why, my poor George, my poor nephew."
"Oh, him? Yes, oh, yes, yes, certainly, certainly. Punch, Punch, oh, this misery will kill me."
Bless you, sir, for these sweet words. I, too, suffer in this dear loss. Were you present during his last moments?"
"Yes, I... Whose last moments?"
"His, the dear departed's."
"Yes, oh, yes, yes, yes. I suppose so, I think so. I don't know. Oh, certainly, I was there. I was there."
"Oh, what a privilege, what a precious privilege. And his last words, oh, tell me his last words. What did he say?"
He said, oh, my head, my head, my head. He said, he never said anything but punch, punch, punch in the presence of the passenger. Oh, leave me, madam, in the name of all that is generous, leave me to my madness, my misery, my despair. A buff trip slip for a 6-cent fare, a pink trip slip for a 3-cent fare. Endurance can no further go. Punch in the presence of the passenger.
My friend's hopeless eyes rested upon mine a pregnant minute, and then he said impressively, "Mark, you do not say anything. You do not offer me any hope. But, ah me, it is just as well. It is just as well. You could not do me any good. The time has long gone by when words could comfort me. Something tells me that my tongue is doomed to wag forever to the jigger of that remorseless jingle. There, there it is coming on me again. A blue trip slip for an 8-cent fare, a buff trip slip for a—" Thus, murmuring faint and fainter, my friend sank into a peaceful trance and forgot his sufferings in a blessed respite. How did I finally save him from the asylum? I took him to a neighboring university and made him discharge the burden of his persecuting rhymes into the eager ears of the poor unthinking students. How is it with them now? The result is too sad to tell. Why did I write this article? It was for a worthy, even a noble purpose. It was to warn you, reader, if you should come across those merciless rhymes, to avoid them. Avoid them as you would a pestilence. 1876. Jim Baker's Blue Jay Yarn. Animals talk to each other, of course. There can be no question about that. But I suppose there are very few people who can understand them. I never knew but one man who could. I knew he could, however, because he told me so himself. He was a middle-aged, simple-hearted miner, who had lived in a lonely corner of California among the woods and mountains a good many years, and had studied the ways of his only neighbors, the beasts and the birds, until he believed he could accurately translate any remark which they made. This was Jim Baker. According to Jim Baker, some animals have only a limited education, and use only very simple words, and scarcely ever a comparison or a flowery figure, whereas certain other animals have a large vocabulary, a fine command of language, and a ready and fluent delivery. Consequently, these latter talk a great deal. They like it. They are conscious of their talent, and they enjoy showing off. Baker said that after long and careful observation, he had come to the conclusion that the blue jays were the best talkers he had found among birds and beasts. Said he,
"There's more to a blue jay than any other creature. He's got more moods and more different kinds of feelings than other creature. And mind you, whatever a blue jay feels, he can put into language. And no mere commonplace language either, but rattling out-and-out book talk. And bristling with metaphor, too. Just bristling. And as for command of language, why, you never see a blue jay get stuck for a word. No man ever did. They just boil out of him. And another thing, I've noticed a good deal, and there's no bird or cow or anything that uses as good grammar as a blue jay. Now, you may say a cat uses good grammar. Well, a cat does. But you let a cat get excited once, you let a cat get to pulling fur with another cat on a shed nights, and you'll hear grammar that will give you the lockjaw. Ignorant people think it's the noise which fighting cats make that is so aggravating, but it ain't so. It's the sickening grammar they use. Now, I've never heard a jay use bad grammar, but very seldom, and when they do, they are as ashamed as a human. They shut right down and leave. Now, you may call a jay a bird. Well, so he is, in a measure, because he's got feathers on him, and don't belong to no church, perhaps. But otherwise, he is just as much a human as you be. And I'll tell you for why. A jay's gifts and instincts and feelings and interests cover the whole ground. A jay hasn't got any more principle than a congressman. A jay will lie, a jay will steal, a jay will deceive, a jay will betray. And 4 times out of 5, a jay will go back on his solemnest promise. The sacredness of an obligation is a thing which you can't cram into no blue jay's head. Now, on top of all this, there's another thing. A jay can outswear any gentleman in the mines. You think a cat can swear? Well, a cat can. But you give a blue jay a subject that calls for his reserve powers, and where is your cat? Don't talk to me. I know too much about this thing. And there's yet another thing, in the one little particular of scolding. Just good, clean, out-and-out scolding. A blue jay can lay over anything, human or divine. Yes, sir, a jay is everything that a man is. A jay can cry, a jay can laugh, a jay can feel shame. A jay can reason and plan and discuss. A jay likes gossip and scandal. A jay has got a sense of humor. A jay knows when he is an ass, just as well as you do. Maybe better. If a jay ain't human, he better take in his sign, that's all. Now, I'm going to tell you a perfectly true fact about some blue jays. When I first begun to understand jay language correctly, there was a little incident happened here. 7 years ago, the last man in this region but me moved away. There stands his house. Been empty ever since. A log house with a plank roof. Just one big room and no more. No ceiling. Nothing between the rafters and the floor. Well, one Sunday morning I was sitting out here in front of my cabin with my cat, taking the sun, and looking at the blue hills and listening to the leaves rustling so lonely in the trees and thinking of the home away yonder in the States that I hadn't heard from in 13 years, when a blue jay lit on that house with an acorn in his mouth and says, "Hello, I reckon I've struck something." When he spoke, the acorn dropped out of his mouth and rolled down the roof, of course, but he didn't care. His mind was all on the thing he had struck. It was a knothole in the roof. He cocked his head to one side, shut one eye, and put the other one to the hole like a possum looking down a jug. And then he glanced up with his bright eyes and gave a wink or two with his wings, which signifies gratification, you understand, and says, "It looks like a hole. It's located like a hole. Blamed if I don't believe it is a hole." And then he cocked his head down and took another look. And he glances up, perfectly joyful this time, winks his wings and his tail both, and says, "Oh, no, this ain't no fat thing, I reckon. If I ain't in luck, why, it's a perfectly elegant hole." So he flew down and got that acorn and fetched it up and dropped it in, and was just tilting his head back with the heavenliest smile on his face, when all of a sudden he was paralyzed into a listening attitude, and that smile faded gradually out of his countenance, like breath off an eraser, and the queerest look of surprise took its place. And then he says, "Why, I didn't hear it fall." He cocked his eye at the hole again and took a long look, raised up and shook his head, stepped around to the other side of the hole and took another look from that side, shook his head again. He studied a while, then he just went into the details, walked round and round the hole and spied into it from every point of the compass. No use. Now he took a thinking attitude on the comb of the roof and scratched the back of his head with his right foot a minute, and finally says, "Well, it's too many for me, that's certain. Must be a mighty long hole. However, I ain't got no time to fool around here. I got to tend to business. I reckon it's all right. Chance it, anyway." So he flew off and fetched another acorn and dropped it in, and tried to flirt his eye to the hole quick enough to see what become of it, but he was too late. He held his eye there as much as a minute, and then he raised up and sighed and says, "Consound it, I don't seem to understand this thing no way. However, I'll tackle her again." He fetched another acorn and done his level best to see what become of it, but he couldn't. He says, "Well, I never struck no such a hole as this before. I'm of the opinion it's a totally new kind of a hole." And then he begun to get mad. He held in for a spell, walking up and down the comb of the roof and shaking his head and muttering to himself. But his feelings got the upper hand of him presently, and he broke loose and cussed himself black in the face. I never see a bird take on so about a little thing. When he got through, he walks to the hole and looks in again for half a minute. And then he says, "Well, you're a long hole and a deep hole, and a mighty singular hole altogether. But I've started in to fill you, and I'm damned if I don't fill you, if it takes 100 years. And with that, away he went. You never see a bird work so since you was born. He laid into his work like a nigger. And the way he hove acorns into that hole for about 2 hours and a half was one of the most exciting and astonishing spectacles I ever struck. He never stopped to take a look any more. He just hove 'em in and went for more. Well, at last he could hardly flop his wings, he was so tuckered out. He comes a-droopin' down once more, sweatin' like an ice pitcher, drops his acorn in and says, 'Now, I guess I've got the bulge on you by this time.' So he bent down for a look. If you'll believe me, when his head come up again, he was just pale with rage. And he says, 'I've shoveled acorns enough in there to keep the family 30 years, and if I can see a sign of one of 'em, I wish I may land in a museum with a belly full of sawdust in 2 minutes. He just had strength enough to crawl up onto the comb and lean his back agin the chimbley, and then he collected his impressions and begun to free his mind. I see in a second that what I had mistook for profanity in the mines was only just the rudiments, as you may say. Another jay was going by and heard him doing his devotions and stops to inquire what was up. The sufferer told him the whole circumstance and says, 'Now yonder's the hole. and if you don't believe me, go and look for yourself." So this fellow went and looked, and comes back and says, "How many did you say you put in there?" "Not any less than 2 tons, says the sufferer. The other jay went and looked again. He couldn't seem to make it out, so he raised a yell, and 3 more jays come. They all examined the hole. They all made the sufferer tell it over again, and then they all discussed it, and got off as many leather-headed opinions about it as an average crowd of humans could have done. And they called in more jays, and then more and more, till pretty soon this whole region appeared to have a blue flush about it. There must have been 5,000 of them. And such another jawing and disputing and ripping and cussing you never heard. Every jay in the whole lot put his eye to the hole and delivered a more chuckle-headed opinion about the mystery than the jay that went there before him. They examined the house all over, too. The door was standing half open, and at last one old jay happened to go and light on it and look in. Of course, that knocked the mystery galley west in a second. There lay the acorns, scattered all over the floor. He flopped his wings and raised a whoop. "Come here," he says. "Come here, everybody. Hanged if this fool hasn't been trying to fill up our house with acorns." They all came a-swooping down like a blue cloud, and as each fellow lit on the door and took a glance, the whole absurdity of the contract that first jay had tackled hit him home, and he fell over backwards, suffocating with laughter. And the next jay took his place and done the same. Well, sir, they roosted around here on the housetop and the trees for an hour and guffawed over that thing like human beings. It ain't any use to tell me a blue jay hasn't got a sense of humor, because I know better. And memory, too. They brought jays here from all over the United States to look down that hole every summer for 3 years.